I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau, Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Sade 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, later on we'll be hearing from Patrick McFarlane of the Libertarian Institute to cover war propaganda in relation to the current crisis in Haiti. But first, political scientist Kristen Lunds Trujillo, who specializes in the political behaviors of rural communities and voters. A while back, I had Professor Nicholas F. Jacobs on to discuss his criticisms of the book White Rural Rage: The Threat to American Democracy. Now, this book has really taken parts of the media by storm. It's been covered on MSNBC and various prestige publications. And I think you can tell from the title what it's getting at. You know, rural America, specifically white rural voters, are a threat to American democracy, according to the authors of that book. So the thing is, that book has some issues, some really glaring issues, according to experts who feel that it miscites data and research. Professor Nicholas Jacobs is one of those critics. Kristen is yet another of those critics, and she's the author of the recent Newsweek piece entitled "White Rural Rage Cites My Research." It gets everything about rural America wrong. So we'll be discussing that article as well as Kristen's thoughts on rural America, how we perceive rural America, both the romanticization and demonization of rural America, and much, much more. So, with that being said, let's get right to it.
Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I'm very happy to be speaking with. She is an assistant professor of political science at the University of South Carolina, Kristen Lunds Trujillo. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, and I'm really glad we could make time to speak because you had a piece in Newsweek that caught my eye. White Rural Rage Cites My Research. It gets everything about rural America wrong. And this op-ed caught my eye after I had another guest on recently to discuss the issues that a lot of academics seem to be having with this White Rural Rage book. So Maybe you could give your background in regards to, your research area of expertise and whatnot, and then we'll get into your issues with white rural rage.
Yeah, absolutely. So just as my background, I'm a political scientist. I study rural politics in particular. That's my specialty. Going back even farther, I grew up on a farm in the upper Midwest, a corn and soybean farm. So I come from a rural background. Once I went to college, I remember I went to college in like a small liberal arts college. But I remember just seeing a very stark cultural difference between where I grew up and even some of the people there who may have been more from the metropolitan area in the state, or nearby states, or even from the coasts. And so that's where I started really seeing this cultural difference. I didn't really investigate that until I decided to go back to grad school. And that was in 2016 during the presidential election where Trump became president. And there, I really became more interested in this urban-rural difference. A lot of people were talking about it. And so that was the subject of my dissertation, especially looking at this idea of a rural identity versus just living in a rural area. So thinking of being from a rural area as a very strong part of who you are as a person, and all the sort of cultural type differences or tendencies that go along with it. Since then, I spent a few years at a postdoc after I graduated from my PhD program, and now I'm an assistant professor. So that's my background. Like I said, I study rural, urban rural politics. I've written a few papers on this subject. One in particular I talked about in the Newsweek article had to do with particularly distrust in expertise, scientific expertise, academic expertise. And so in that paper, I find that people who really see being a rural person as a part of their identity, as who they are more likely to distrust experts and intellectuals. And that was something that was cited in the White Rural Rage book.
Right by Tom Scheller and Paul Waldman. Yeah.
That's correct. Yep. And so that was one of the big things that I really caught on, was that there was a sad irony happening where those authors were criticizing rural people for supposedly being, anti-intellectual and this being problematic for democracy and society, but at the same token, not really understanding their own position as academics and how, by just scapegoating this group completely and not trying to understand some of the reasons why there might be that distrust, it's making it worse. And so that was really the basis for my critique of the book. There are lots of other problems I have too with it. But I think the biggest piece of information or the biggest message I want to get out is that, we as academics have a responsibility not to scapegoat a group along demographic lines, especially. And so that was my big piece.
Are you familiar with Nicholas F. Jacobs? I had him on recently, and I believe he recommended you as well. Are there a number of academics in this area of looking at, rural America and the urban-rural divide that are taking issue with this book?
Yeah, so I guess to begin with, there are a lot of in political science in particular, it's not a huge subfield that not a lot of academics study urban rural division. It's kind of a burgeoning field. It's developing, so more people are getting more interested in it, but there aren't a whole lot of us. At the same token, among people who do study urban rural politics, at least the ones I've talked to, the more prominent ones that I know of, a lot of them have condemned the book, either outwardly. Nick Jacobs has been one, Cal Moonis as well. Others have told me, sort of as an aside, I agree with this. Thank you for saying this. I've had people studying not just urban rural politics, but also just, for instance, rural public health, rural sociologists, coming up to me and saying, I agree, this book is really doing a disservice and it's making things worse. So I think, at least within the academic community, from what I've encountered so far, among people studying rural politics or rural related topics, there's been a pushback against this particular book.
Now, you said that they cited your research on distrust of academic expertise. What was your research, and how did Schaller and Waldman maybe portray that research in their book? And what did you disagree with their portrayal?
Yeah, so when it comes to my research in particular, they cited, as I referenced before, that one article that looks at rural identity, I found, tends to predict greater levels of that distrust. And so how, in terms of characterizing the study, just the actual like blurbs where they cite my research, that was actually pretty clear. I don't think the actual, you know, like paragraph or whatever sentence where they said my work.
Yeah,
was...
you're not saying they misrepresented your work. I think you even say that in the article. Yeah.
Whereas other studies, they did. but for mine, no. I would say that the biggest potential issue that's related to not quite misrepresentation, but sort of a mischaracterization, is that, as I mentioned before, I study rural identity. So this idea of a person feeling that being like a country person is who the person is. And so that means that a lot of people might hold what we call a rural identity, but don't live in a rural area. And this has happened a lot over the, especially since over the span of the 20th century, a lot of people grew up in rural areas and left. And so that means that a lot of people socialized as coming from a small town or rural area. They moved to a city and they feel like, you know, I'm still culturally kind of like that. You also get people, you know, that might live in the middle of Manhattan, but they really like country music. They like the idea of going out and hunting and fishing. They really like the idea of different cultural, you know, their cultural identity is very much tied to what they would perceive as rural. And so this rural identity would encompass those people as well. And so I'm saying that it's a larger cultural conflict between this idea of what rural is and this perception of experts. The problem is that they use that research as saying that that's just rural people, which is not necessarily true. They contextualize it as, well, white rural people are the problem. And here's a study saying that they're anti-intellectual. Well, that's not necessarily what I was saying. I was saying that this identity is counter to intellectualism, if that makes sense. So
can
it's
you
not
delve quite- more into that distinction and maybe where you think maybe Waldman and Schaller, the people promoting this book, could maybe... It sounds like you're saying they're not introspecting about the reasons as to why maybe people with a rural identity feel this way. Can you delve into that?
Yes. And then there's that aspect too. They, a lot of, and this is throughout the book, a lot of the tone of it is blame and this idea that rural people should be held to this. They're making these choices, these autonomous choices. And even though they acknowledge some structural changes or larger changes happening as a demographic group, they don't really see it as sort of a systematic like difference or reasons why people might feel this way. So in terms of distrust of experts, I mean, in particular, there's a lot of reasons why this might happen. So first of all, if we're thinking about people who grew up rural or do live in a rural area, those are the biggest groups of rural identifiers. There's a tendency of social distance. So people who are rural identifiers a lot of times don't know someone who's a scientist, who's a professor, even who's, you know, a family member who's a doctor or a lawyer. So there's a socioeconomic tendency. And that results in, say, for instance, 90% of people working in science professions do not come from a rural background. So there's this disparity. So some of it's the social distance of not knowing people. Some of it is, and along with this lack of access for people who grew up in rural areas and opportunities. Another one has to do with exactly what the authors of the book are doing, where academics have a tendency to not to characterize or intellectuals or others that have more power in society is there's a tendency to characterize rural people as a certain way, a stereotypical way of being backwards, of being ignorant. And so this creates this tension and this distrust because there's this perception that they don't really care, and then that they're not looking out in the best interests of those individuals because there's these negative sorts of stereotypes and ways of speaking. There's a book also by Arlie Hochschild, Strangers in Their Own Land, which Hochschild goes and looks, I think, interviews people in rural Louisiana, trying to figure out why it is that even though there's all this environmental degradation, why is it that the people there are so distrustful of the EPA? So that's a government agency, but it's sort of tied to something similar, this distrust of elites. And they find that the problem is the perception of the people that she interviewed was that you have this agency coming in, telling people what to do, giving people certain regulations, certain rules and restrictions, and yet they still see environmental degradation. A lot of times they feel like those restrictions, yeah, it might help the environment, but it might also be harmful in the community for some various reasons. You know, it might increase costs and then hurt small business owners. So there is no real compensation, for instance, for some of those things. And so that breeds distrust as well. This idea that sometimes government or experts will come into rural areas and sort of tell them how to act or behave. And so in some cases that breeds distrust. You know, it's not to say that I'm not necessarily saying that, well, the EPA is wrong or that we shouldn't go and try to decrease environmental pollution. It's just that while we're doing that, we need to keep in mind that there might be other effects that people experience in certain areas that also need to be mitigated along with that, if that makes sense.
You know, the response I got when I had Nicholas Jacobs on for people that have been defensive of the book is they'll say, well, you know, you guys are only focusing on, you keep talking about rural people, but, you know, the book is only, they're focusing not on rural people, but on white rural people. How do you respond to people that say, oh, you know, you're misrepresenting the book if you're not honing in on, you know, that they're just talking about white rural populations?
Well, in some ways, that's an ironic criticism because a lot of times when the authors cite something about, you know, rural, like white rural America is this way or that way, they actually talk about just rural Americans. They don't actually hone in on the white rural American, even though that's the title of their book. So there is that particular problem where even the authors themselves, they make the case in some instances that it's just white rural people. And they have a chapter on non-whites, which is great. I'm glad there's more visibility given to that particular population. But then at the same time, they'll cite, for instance, the political violence article by Cal Moonis et al. You know, they cite that rural people are more politically violent. Well, they never say, well, white people in rural areas are more. That's they're not necessarily right. So the study itself isn't backing up that it's white rural. Now, it could be the case that it is. It could be the case that it isn't. With that particular article, they also misrepresent it because Moonis et al. Find that people higher in rural resentment are more likely to be support political violence, but rural residents are not. And so there's some complexity there that got misrepresented. But yeah, in terms of it being specifically about white rural Americans, I mean, there's going to be, I think a lot of the motivation for that is that there's a partisan difference in terms of white rural Americans on average tend to be more supportive of the Republican Party. And a lot of the criticisms that the authors have are really directed towards people in the Republican Party. And so, you know, in that sense, they are right to isolate that group, but at the same time, again, they're not really necessarily making the argument, making the sound argument that it's white rural Americans in all these cases. That makes sense.
I also wanted to ask about, you know, how the book tackles the issue of belief in conspiracy theories and, tropes about rural American Christian nationalism.
I pointed this out, Nick Jacobs has pointed this out, that some of the evidence used for, say, QAnon conspiracy endorsement, some of the data used was a very small sample, not representative of rural America in terms of, they might be rural Americans, but they might disproportionately be from a few states, not including people from other states. Again, they don't specifically look at white. And then once you control for, so they'll present, say, averages. I can't remember the exact 17% urban versus whatever 20-some percent rural believe this conspiracy theory. They don't necessarily account for other factors when they make that statement. So it could be that maybe that difference is accounted for by living in a rural area or being Republican, excuse me, or education level or something else. If that's true, then a lot of the reason why we see that difference isn't because necessarily they're rural people, it's because of a sorting of demographics, right? So it's not rural specific. It's not that they're necessarily the issue in quotations. It's just that you're picking up on that because of some other factor, if that makes sense. Again, too, some of those percentages aren't that different. Both are minorities believing that the average rural American, the average white rural American, isn't necessarily going to believe in some of these extreme conspiracy theories. So to say that as a blanket statement, white rural Americans are, believe in all these conspiracy theories, well, that's not necessarily true. Even if there is a slightly higher tendency, that's not necessarily the case. That's being misrepresented. In terms of white Christian nationalism, again, there wasn't really evidence to back it up. There's an ecological fallacy issue happening, where they think, okay, white evangelicals are more likely to support this Christian nationalism. White evangelicals are found percentage-wise, proportionally more in rural areas. Therefore, rural Americans are higher in white Christian nationalism. That's not necessarily true. You can't just make that assumption jumping from different levels of, rural area to across these demographics. I do know this isn't published work, but there is a scholar, a graduate student who's doing some excellent research on religion in rural America. And he had found actually that white Christian nationalism was not more or less likely in rural America, controlling for other factors. So I look forward to that being published. That's not been published or peer reviewed yet. But again, that points to this idea that the authors make this claim, but don't really have solid evidence that that's the case. They just sort of make assumptions, jump, they might have a piece of evidence, but then make these sort of logical jumps to get to that conclusion.
Do you want to talk a little bit about more about rural identity in regards to, I guess you point out that a lot of rural identity is based more around feeling pride about being in a rural community rather than hating the urban community.
Yeah, absolutely. So I found this in my dissertation, and it was on a smaller sample, so it is kind of tentative, but I do have ongoing research on a much larger and more representative sample of rural Americans, looking at different emotions felt towards fellow rural Americans and then different emotions felt towards urban Americans. And I find so far that among just rural residents are actually more likely on average to feel positive emotions towards urban areas than negative emotions towards rural areas, first of all. And that kind of makes sense if you think about it. I mean, a lot of people who live in rural America might have friends or family who have moved to urban centers. They might occasionally go there for like vacations or to do something for fun. So to say or to assume necessarily that rural America is always raging against urban America is kind of ridiculous, I guess, of an assumption. Among rural identifiers, people who identify as rural, they are much more likely to feel those positive emotions towards their own group, Rural Americans are great. I really like rural America, which makes sense. That's how they view themselves. So they're going to probably feel positively towards it. And for them, it's much less about the negative attitudes towards urban centers as well. People who feel rural resentment tend to have more, compared to those two other groups, tend to have more negative views of urban America, as you could probably imagine. But a lot of the reasons that established research on rural resentment has essentially consensus saying that the resentment's coming from a feeling of left behind or being forgotten or being disrespected. And so it's not necessary, there's some contextualization of why there might be that particular resentment. And when I say this in my article too, in terms of how people feel politically, over time in the US, it's become more nationalized. So it's this anger, rage that anyone might feel. I don't think that's limited to rural America. According to political science research, that is not limited to rural America. There is just more dislike of the political other that's happened increasingly over time in the United States. A lot of people too, in rural America, and I cited this study, feel more satisfied where they live compared to urban Americans. And so, yeah, there's just that rage part's also not accurate, or at least it doesn't take into account some of the other research. It doesn't account for how Americans broadly view the political other. To isolate it just to rural Americans hating, you know, their particular others is not accurate. We know, for instance, that Democrats and Democratic groups strongly dislike the other side. Majorities of partisans, you know, whether on the left or the right, think that their child shouldn't marry someone of the opposite, affiliated with the opposite political party. To say that that's rural specific, I think is a mischaracterization.
Is it okay? Could you stay a little bit longer? Because I had a few more questions, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you mentioned earlier how some people who may not even be from a rural area may take up a rural identity. And I've seen that a lot, actually, having lived in the city. I've met people who, you know, have never really spent time in rural America that take up, I guess, what they consider the aesthetic of rural America. You know, like, I'm going to wear trucker caps or whatever. And how much do you think that feeds into just maybe harmful sort of
types.
Culture war and stereotypes and just polarization?
Yeah, so I think it's a mixed bag. So I think people from rural areas who see, you know, the urban rural identifiers who maybe like aren't actually from a rural area, they kind of see them as posers in a way. But at the same token, or you know, at the same time, the research I looked at finds that rural identifiers, regardless of where they currently live, tend to have similar values when it comes to politics and political related values. They tend to have similar political leanings. So at the same time, there might also be some more likely affinity between those two groups than not. You know, I think it's a fine line between being like, oh yeah, I love the country music and I've got my Carhartt jacket. You know, that being a respect for what's perceived to be rural culture, versus like we're starting to stereotype, you know. I don't think necessarily that liking rural culture as it's perceived is necessarily a bad thing. But I do remember an example of this. I remember when I went to college, there was like a farmhouse in quotations. And so it's like this little house on campus, and then you can like join the club, and then you like grow organic vegetables or whatever. And so I was at first interested. I was like, oh, this sounds good. This is going to be like 4-H or like FFA. And then I joined. It was a bunch of these hipsters just like that, like wearing flannel and like, you know, pretending to be like these organic farmers. I'm just like, this is bullshit. So yeah, I think there's a tension there, definitely, but in some cases, I think there is like a similarity and a there might be like avenues for mutual respect, but at the same time, it's sort of like, what are you doing? You know, you're not exactly like us type of thing.
So I want to get into the potential problems that you know, this book poses with regards to our political climate and the polarization we're facing. You're an academic, so I'm not expecting you to get polemical with it, but I just feel like this is I feel like this book sort of you know, is almost handing a victory to the sort of Trump and MAGA contingent of the Republican Party, by which I mean, you know, you're sort of feeding into, you know, resentment with this book. So that bothers me a lot. I think it's sort of doing Trump's work for him.
Well, yeah, it's just pointing out that he say, look, you know, these East Coast liberals do indeed hate you. It's the deplorables all over again, is what it is. And yeah, I don't think it's doing anyone any favors. From a scientific perspective, if it had been much more sound and that was the conclusion, then fine, so be it. But I think even then, there's a responsibility to communicate this a certain way without worsening polarization. I mean, even in, like, I talked to my family, I talked to my mom, and a lot of people in rural America, even who are Democrats, feel like the Democratic Party has left. They just don't care. There's not a lot of effort to try to talk to that, you know, people in rural America by the Democratic Party.
And this book contributes to that in a way,
exactly.
Because if you're a Democratic strategist and you're reading this book, you're thinking, why even waste time going out to rural America? Yeah.
Right. And so if you're communicating, because this book is also going to go to, you know, political strategists or people, practitioners, essentially, not just academics. And so, yeah, as someone who might be working on a Democratic campaign, the thought might be, oh, these people are beyond, you know, beyond trying to persuade or trying to help from our political party. And so I think that's a huge disservice. I think, you know, to write off all of rural America especially white rural America, is thinking the same way politically. As always, voting for one particular party, I think, you know, we've seen a switch over time where rural areas have become much more Republican in terms of voting patterns. But I mean, that's been fairly recent, which means it could always reverse. There could be local level elections where Democrats might do particularly well. And so I think it's problematic to just assume that, well, saying these people are all the crazies and they're never going to, you know, they have no moderate stances. They have no things that, you know, the other political party can offer. I think that's doing a massive disservice, and it's worsening this polarization because it's worsening the perception from the elite side that, oh yes, they're really beyond, you know, beyond converting, or that's wrong, beyond persuading. And then
we're just reaching out to,
yeah, that's the word. Reaching out. And then on the rural side, you know, it's again this emphasizing this group doesn't care about us. The quote Democratic elites, end quote, do not care about us, is the perception.
Was there anything that you weren't able to include in the article with regards to maybe criticisms you had of the book? That you think were, what do you think the most egregious aspect of this white rural rage book is?
I mean, the tone is just a huge one. Again, you could take all the data that they cite in the book and have a completely different tone. Again, it just feels like the tone is purposefully inflammatory. I think that's the most egregious part of this. You know, one thing I've talked about quite a few criticisms at this point. You know, the ecological fallacy is probably another huge one that's a problem. You know, thinking they might include an example of like a state. And I think at one point they included an example of South Carolina, saying that, well, South Carolina as a state did this whole thing. assuming that, okay, because South Carolina has a disproportionately rural population, that this statewide thing means it was a rural thing. Problem is that in South Carolina, there's actually not the same urban-rural division as there is elsewhere. A lot of suburbs and even like cities, smaller cities such as Myrtle Beach, are predominantly Republican. And in rural South Carolina, you have a lot of African Americans, and so they tend to vote Democrat. And so trying to say that South Carolina is this, you know, example of white rural rage by looking at something that's statewide really, really collapses all those differences that, again, go against their argument. One last thing this is maybe a smaller thing, but I thought it was indicative, was there was this whole tirade on rural Americans, white rural Americans, men in particular, owning pickup trucks. And so there's a lot of, which, you know, I get there's some criticisms you can make, but a lot of it was based on this this idea that all the pickup trucks just, they're trying to increase their masculinity and like making up for something, blah, blah, blah. Well, they didn't mention that a lot of people who work in rural areas need pickup trucks for their jobs, which like my dad always had a pickup truck because he was a farmer. He needed to haul stuff back and forth. I mean, you can't do that with like a Prius. So I don't know. That was...
In the research you've conducted on rural Americans, whether it's just rural Americans or white rural Americans, are there other lenses? Like, I guess what I'm trying to get at, and I'm trying to put it towards, is this book, I guess, is looking at it through the urban rural divide and the, you know, they're saying white rural Americans, but, you know, couldn't you also look at, you know, what rural Americans believe in their culture and how they may differ even within rural America based on, I don't know, things like income or other factors. Do you see what I'm getting at there? Like, I think you could find differences even amongst rural Americans based on different factors in their lives.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's some of the issue too. They don't really parse that out. Just assuming white rural Americans are all the same. I mean, there's a lot of different things you could look at. You know, I'm interested in doing a project, and hopefully I can get this going, looking at, there's this assumption that rural America is like the white working class. Well, we don't, there's actually quite a bit of variation there. We don't know for sure. There's not a lot of research on how much it is necessarily class-based versus being role-specific, but those two are kind of tied together. So looking at income, education level, things like that, there are college-educated people, quite a few in rural America. You know, religiosity is nationally a big predictor of political attitudes, of political affiliation. There's variation within white rural America on that. You know, there are all these different things you could look at, partisanship and ideology. That's a big one too. There's a significant proportion, minority, but a proportion of white rural Americans that are Democrats. And this was just kind of like glossed over, which again, there's going to be variation there. So yeah, I think there are these like demographic differences amongst white rural Americans that are going to vary quite a bit. Even, I mean, there are even some counties still in white that are predominantly white rural American that are more swing counties still, even today. So I'm thinking like the upper Mississippi River Valley, which is southeastern Minnesota, southwestern Wisconsin, northeastern Iowa, and northwestern Illinois. That's predominantly white, and it tends to be more swing, swings back and forth more in elections. Thinking about northern Minnesota and the very, very top part of northern Wisconsin, there's been historically, those have been swing counties. A lot of historical union membership there has changed the political tendencies. And that's another thing you could look at, union membership. Economic attitudes, economic sector where people work is another big one. There's research.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've always been interested in, I think a union worker may have different views on certain political issues than, say, like, I don't know, maybe like a small business owner. But, I think these factors matter more than, people admit sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's not a lot of research on that within rural America. Even union membership, there's not a lot. It's just because union memberships decline so much, I think it sort of a lot of scientific interest. But I was going to say there's work by Dante Scala and Kenneth Johnson. They're political scientists. One's a political scientist, one's a geographer. And they find that among rural areas, places where the economy was more dependent on agriculture were much more supportive of Donald Trump in 2016, whereas places that were much more recreation focused, tourism focused, were much less so. And so there's even within there that variation in, the types of jobs people have, which makes sense.
Before closing out here, what are the maybe pitfalls of doing research work into rural America and beliefs in rural America? Because it seems like you said at the beginning, there's not as many people doing this research. It's very focused field. Is it an under-researched field, and are there maybe problems with or difficulties or challenges with doing research on this issue of rural America?
Yeah, it's a great question. One big question or one big issue working in this area is measurement. How do you measure rural? There are 70 some objective ways to classify urban rural residency. Think like the census has one or a few, the USDA has one. There are all these different ways to potentially measure rural. And then there's also the subjective, do you just ask people based on what they feel their area looks like to them, which is going to have a lot of variation. And a lot of these different measurements aren't that, there's a lot of difference. Like, if you just pinpoint a particular area, some of those classifications might say one thing, small town or something. Some might say, like, suburb. So there's a lot of variation there. And so that's one big problem, I think, in trying to work in this area. Is understanding what is rural and what the boundaries are. And yeah, I think the other big challenge is just isolating what, is it actually, is something actually rural specific, or is it just picking up on some of these other like rural adjacent things? Are we just picking up on socioeconomic status? Is rural showing up as something different because there are more Republicans that live in rural areas proportionally, compared to, say, cities where proportionally there are more Democrats? In terms of absolute numbers, that's not always true. A statistic I like to throw out is that more people voted for Donald Trump in New York City in 2016 than people who voted for Trump in South Dakota and Montana combined. So it's also, but anyway, so I think, yeah, isolating, is that a rural thing or is that just like a something else thing, is another big challenge, I think, to these studies. And then the final one, I think, too, is overcoming. There's a dichotomy that tends to happen in our society with rural. It's either like the White Rural Rage book, where there's all these negative stereotypes and just like seeing rural people as backwards or problematic. And then
Or there's the romanticized,
there's the
it's the salt of the earth.
oh, these are the morally correct people. These are the true Americans in quotations. That's also problematic. I think there's this over idealized version of rural America among some people as well. And so I think trying to find the accurate portrayal is sometimes tricky, because there's so many associations, like different associations people have with rural America.
That's the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and I'll include an anecdote for myself to talk about this, but I worry that it's very hard, I think, for people to get outside of the stereotypes they may have about rural America, especially if you're from an urban area. So I've had to, travel, maybe 2 years ago, I had to travel from the city of Pittsburgh to Florida, and we went through a lot of rural areas during that time. And I remember stopping in one rural area, and we decided to sleep in the car for that night. And I think it's because I've been bombarded by, cultural stereotypes and pop culture, especially as a horror movie person.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
like, oh my God, I feel like I'm in a Wrong Turn movie or Texas Chainsaw movie or something. And I stopped myself and I said, wow, that's like a really horrible stereotype to have. How do we overcome the, do you think there's a way that we could better overcome these sort of really negative stereotypes? Because I even catch myself doing it occasionally, and it's not good. It's wrong-headed of me, but I have to pinch myself sometimes.
Yeah. So I think you pointed exactly to one big factor, which is how culture portrays rural America. It's either like one or the other, right? It's either like horror show, unless it's a zombie movie. Zombie movies, you like want to be in rural areas. You're like safe there.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Or if, I don't know, you have like a serial killer or something, usually that's, well, sometimes. Anyway, media tends to show rural America as either like really dangerous and scary, or this is where you're like safe totally. And so I think shows that portray rural America as more complex, I think would help on, showing similarities, showing any differences that might be a little bit more nuanced, I think would be good in terms of just cultural perceptions. Cause a lot of times our stereotypes are based on these sort of like media portrayals. I think too, having, yeah, I guess that's the big one. Thinking about rural people as being a group that's been shut out from certain advantages, I think is another one. So trying to get more rural high schoolers interested in STEM careers or something like that. So
can you explain that a little bit more? Because I always worry about like the pushback I'll get for an episode, and I'm always trying to second guess, well, what's the next email I'm going to get, the hate mail? I'm sure there's going to be someone that's saying, well, what does a white rural American, what disadvantages do they have?
Yeah, so there's scientific studies showing that rural high schoolers are less likely to go into a STEM field after they graduate, whether that be in college or going through college or technical school or something else. They're just much less likely to enter into that type of field. So I think providing more guidance in terms of, this is an option you can choose. This is an option that is good for you, a smart move, good for society, things like that. A lot of rural high schools are disadvantaged in terms of not getting as much, public schools specifically, not having as much money. There's more of a teacher shortage in rural America. And so, yeah, to some extent, one could be like, well, maybe they should make better choices or work harder or something like that. But then at the same token, there are these more broader things happening that limit that or that don't present that as an option as much. Especially if you have somebody who's interested in the sciences, but maybe doesn't know how to go that path, that's another thing. So I guess in that way, just emphasizing that there are these opportunities and then getting more of that, that means that in some of these sectors, such as academia, you get more perspectives from rural people, and then that diminishes the stereotypes that people have. Cause it's like, oh, this person's from small town America. They're not these horrible backward stereotypes that I thought it would be. So, and in that way, I'm saying that would help, I think, in combating some of the stereotypes.
Last thing, do you, we've talked about the urban rural divide, I guess, culturally, but Is there any research on like similarities?
On similarities across urban rural
Well,
spectrum.
yeah.
Yeah, so I think I wrote a paper looking at policy preferences just generally across a bunch of different things. Healthcare spending or government service spending, abortion attitudes, a bunch of other like stuff like that. And my co-author and I found that there's no urban rural difference once you account for the partisan difference. So again, that's an example of it's not actually urban rural. We don't actually have that much different in terms of how we tend to think. It's just we're sorted by partisanship, but it's not a rural or urban thing. It's a Democrat versus Republican thing. We all have common culture as well. I mean, it's not like we're living in completely different worlds. I grew up watching a lot of the same shows as other people my age. I have that sort of common experience in other ways, by my age cohort, by like other interests I have, common experiences. I mean, us all as Americans have tendencies, regardless of where we live, that I think we share quite a bit with one another, rather than it just being, a completely different culture.
Do you with regards to that last point, I think there's also this stereotype that rural America is like the land of, the don't tread on me, I hate government type stereotype, But Nicholas F. Jacobs said to me that, from his research, he doesn't think that, necessarily rural Americans are anti-government so much as maybe they have issues at times with how they perceive the federal government compared to the state government. But there, he was very adamant in saying that it's not necessarily that there's a complete anti-governance sentiment in rural America. Do you agree with that or?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, most of like the vast majority of Americans, urban, rural, speaking again to the White Rural Rage book, are really supportive of like the like democratic norms. And then on the other side of things, like trust in government across the board in the United States is just really low. Like everyone's just like, ugh. I don't think that's necessarily an urban or rural thing. I think, again, that's sort of just a shared experience. I think maybe there could be some more like additional factors contributing to distrust of government in rural America, just because in rural America, you're physically away from centers of power. There's a perception that government doesn't really serve specifically rural areas, and I'm talking about like Kathy Kramer's book, for instance. But to say that the majority by any means are these, Gadsden flag waving, I hate any government intervention, I think is silly. I don't think that's reflective at all. I think some of that has to do also with confounding rural with certain regional stereotypes and other stereotypes as well. I would agree with that, what Jacob said
Is
with
there
rural.
anything you want to say in closing? Just, I mean, I think we've covered a lot of ground here, but I'm hoping the message people get out of this is that, the White Rural Rage book is not everything it's caught made out to be. Maybe, I mean, I'll be honest, I just kind of feel like it's a dumb book, and I'm actually kind of just flabbergasted at the fact that it's getting so much attention because I think there's a lot of problems with it. What do you want my listeners to get out of the conversation, though? I'm hoping my listeners get out of it that I'm not a fan of the White Rural Rage book, but what do you want my listeners to get out of the conversation?
Yeah, I think, books like White Rural Rage get attention from the media because our media environment prioritizes things that have shock value. Our media environment has siloed itself into sort of like, oh, this is, these News source A caters to more left-wing audience. News source B caters to more right-wing audience. And so because of that, a lot of times these books that are more shocking or that are making these...
Yeah, we forgot to mention, I mean, you want to talk shocking. I mean, the title is like very sensational. The Absolutely. Subtitle is The Threat to American Democracy. You know, like rural America is the greatest threat to American democracy. I was like, oh. That's...
In isolation, yes. Right. Nobody else has any, yeah. I think there's a tendency, you know, even me writing the Newsweek article is a little bit conflictual to me, because I know that the more I sort of push back against it, the more people are going to be outraged about it. And then the more attention the book gets, you know what I'm saying? Part of me is just like, you know, maybe we should just all collectively ignore this. So yeah, I think there's a tendency for these kinds of books to get more attention than they necessarily should. You know, I want people to keep in mind that there's other people working in this area, other academics don't support many of the claims, most of the claims of the book. They don't support the overarching takeaway that they're the biggest threat to democracy. I don't think that's shared by most people in the field. And yeah, it's a book that I think just is going to create more problems than help people really understand what's happening.
Well, hey, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. Is there any way my listeners can keep up with any? I mean, are you going to be writing more op-eds? Do you write anywhere else, or?
Here and there. I mean, you know, they can follow me on Twitter. Sometimes I put, you know, stuff related to rural America, some of my research, other stuff I might write on, or X, Twitter X. And my handle is at K Lunds Trujillo, if you want to follow.
Next up, the Libertarian Institute's Patrick McFarlane joins us to discuss the issue of war propaganda in relationship to the crisis happening in Haiti. You see, recently, right-wing culture warriors have picked up on this story about Haitian cannibal gangs. And it turns out that this story may have a few issues, and that it could be feeding into some pro-war agendas with regard to Haiti and U.S. foreign policy. We'll be discussing that in the conversation to follow with Patrick McFarlane. With that being said, let's get right to it. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I haven't had on before, but we've corresponded. We come from very different ends of the political spectrum. However, I think we both have a skepticism of war and the war state. So Patrick McFarlane writes for the Libertarian Institute, and also fill you in on his other projects. How are you doing, Patrick?
I'm doing great. I'm really glad we can make this work.
Patrick, anything I left out there? I know Libertarian Institute, anything else? Or
I'm the host of Vital Dissent, which has been hosted on the Institute, but it's all there. I mean, if you in the right hand column.
Okay. So the reason I wanted to have you on was you have this piece out, Culture Warriors Spread Disinfo on Haitian Cannibals. First off, people have been living under a rock, or they're just not paying attention to what's happening in Haiti. What is this talk of Haitian cannibals all about?
Yeah, well, right. This story was fun because, I mean, it wasn't fun because of the subject matter, although it's salacious, you know, but it's kind of a story within a story. And I'll fill you in on the second part because it has more to do with who was saying this, I think. But you know, the U.S. has such a long history of intervention in Haiti, it's hard to know where to start. But the immediate story really kind of begins where the president, Jovenel Moïse, was kind of overstaying his term, although he had arguments as to why that was fine. And so he's assassinated right before he's going to hand over the reins of power, I think, to Claude Joseph, who was his chosen successor. But then he's assassinated, and Claude Joseph, I don't think he could really assert himself in power, but the U.S.-backed Ariel Henry gets the nod. And so he is, he's kind of, you know, more friendly. He's seen as a puppet He's more friendly with the U.S., but seen as kind of a U.S. puppet. So he gets installed. And for, you know, 2.5 years since that happened, he's really been unable to get control over the nation. And there's been a lot of from the gangs, there's been a lot of unrest. But in the midst of it is this character, Jimmy Chirizé, Barbecue is his nickname. And so he is a man of the people. You know, if you've seen Dan Cohen's documentary about him, and Kim Ives have done great work about him. I don't know the facts, and I'm not like an expert on Haiti. I haven't been there like Dan Cohen has, and Kim Ives works there. So I don't know Chirizé. I haven't seen the documentary and couldn't like cite things that he's exactly said, but knowing that he is a man of the people, at least that's what they say, and that he cares about getting these people together and having like kind of a bottom up grassroots approach to security, the security that the state hasn't been able to provide for these people there. So in Henri's absence, he rallies the support of all these groups, brings them together to start a rebellion while Henri is out of the country trying to secure a Kenyan military intervention. So Henri can't get back in the country when he wants to, and he's pressured by the international community to step down. Now, Jimmy Barbecue Chirizé kind of has this rebellion has gone full circle. They've kind of taken over Port-au-Prince, and then comes this narrative of the cannibals.
And it's not the only time that there's, you know, been that narrative used in history of, oh, you know, they're doing this horrible thing to the corpses, or they're eating baby, not just with Haiti, but I'm saying when wars happen, this kind of like atrocity story pops up, and sometimes atrocity stories can be true in wartime, but then other times, you know, you have to question them. I mean, the Iraqi baby incubator story comes to mind immediately. That's the one I go to, but I mean, people do have to question these stories at times because, you know, propaganda floats around during, you know, periods of war.
And that's kind of what I've specialized in, things that I write about usually. I mean, I write about China a lot and Taiwan and kind of that, the new Cold War. But the other thing, yeah, is this, I'm fascinated with moral injury too, and killing and war, but also this war propaganda and atrocity stories. One thing that comes to mind, JG, you mentioned the atrocity stuff. One of the most famous stories is in World War One, the British propaganda ministry circulated this story that the Germans were distilling fat and glycerin from the corpses of their war dead. And there's this, I just wrote a piece about this for my ebook I'm working on, but there were all these firsthand reports from Germany of that they were shipping big bundles of corpses on trains, that they were taking them off and boiling in these huge cauldrons in like the corpse factory. And it just turns out that the very kernel of this was a mistranslation of a German word. And everything sprouted legs from that and ran with it. And in this story in Haiti, there was almost less than that. I mean, it's a similar kind of thing, but there was less than that.
So who are the main players that helped, I guess, spread this narrative? I guess Ian Miles Chong was, you know, one of the figures that came up.
Yeah, he was. And as far as I could tell, he was one of the original people that was circulating this story, that the earliest that I could find was his tweet. It was an X post. So what he did is he completely did not cite any source at all for this report. He just put out a tweet with pictures of unrest from Haiti, which you could find anywhere. I have no idea when they were from, but just such is the case of Haiti, is that, you know, it's constantly an unrest. So he posted these pictures and said that Haiti is in, you know, chaos, anarchy, turmoil, that there are cannibal gangs that are besieging the presidential palace in Port-au-Prince. That's what he said. And then there was, you know, a lot of people that took it and ran with it, including kind of Elon Musk made several tweets. Like, he responded to Ian Miles Chiang's original post, assuming it was true. And, you know, whether he knew what he was doing or not, whether he was being reckless with the information, When the richest man in the world, the owner of the platform, responds to something assuming it's true, it just has the effect of adding credibility to the story. And so all of these right-wing kind of culture warrior influencers on
libs of TikTok, etc.
Yeah, and even Tim Pool picked it up and was, you know, made some kind of a sarcastic tweet about it, but assuming that the information was factual in that. And then Dom Lucor, I don't know exactly how you pronounce his name, he tweeted a video from a couple of years ago saying that it was Jimmy Chirizé, but the video was a Haitian gangster who was burning a corpse in a fire and then cut a piece off of the leg and ate it in the video. But he said it was Jimmy Chirizé, and people believed him.
So you also, I think you wrote about, didn't some reporter from NBC News try to inquire about this to Chong or?
Yes. So Chong made a post about David Ingram from NBC. And I think this happened with the, you know, the Falun Gong Chinese organ harvesting story too, is that, well, not specifically that story, but with Falun Gong itself, where you get the mainstream media actually doing their jobs when it means trying to nail Trump supporters or, you know, dissident figures of all stripes. So with Falun Gong, there's this, you know, supernaturalist Chinese dissident group that owns the Epoch Times in New Tang Dynasty. I don't know if you've heard of these organizations.
I'm very familiar with the Epoch Times and I'm familiar with Falun Gong. Yeah, yeah.
So
they're very culty.
They are. I mean, they have a charismatic leader who lives in a compound, and like all of the adherents, the practitioners, they do a job where they don't get paid and it all goes to the group, that kind of stuff, weird medical treatment stuff. But so David Ingram essentially starts doing his job when it means nailing people like Ian Miles Chong. And so he sent Ian Miles an email asking what his source is for this Haitian cannibals claim. And in the email, David Ingram asks, oh, well, there's one report that I can find that's recent about cannibalism in Haiti. And it's from the British Star Express. So it's the Daily Express US. So I assume it's the British Express United States version of that. And I think the Express UK is kind of a tabloid. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
So it's kind of a tabloid, but the Express article, it cites a report from an on the ground reporter, and the on the ground reporter says essentially, well, here's what the article says. A journalist on the ground told Daily Express US that cannibalism has been witnessed on the streets as the violence reaches, quote, unprecedented levels. Speaking anonymously, the reporter said, Haiti is living in a total chaotic situation right now. It is total chaos everywhere, especially in the capital where I am right now. And following the interview, the journalist said via text message, cannibalism is not widespread, but definitely an indication of the worsening situation. It definitely happens on a few occasions. So the original report is from an anonymous reporter on the ground, supposedly. The original report is hearsay because the reporter is saying, well, I didn't see cannibalism. Someone told me they saw cannibalism. And then he says, it's not widespread, but it definitely happens on a few occasions. So Ian Miles Chong took this, and all of a sudden it's cannibal gangs are besieging the palace in Port-au-Prince. So it's
in this case, report. Ingram actually was asking very legit questions to.
Yes.
Ian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible to me. And I think, you know, I alluded to the story within the story before, is that if you go through, like, I don't want to be too alarmist about it, and it's a little speculative, but if you go through Elon Musk's replies, he is always like reaction baiting with all of these right-wing social justice, you know, anti-social justice commentators on Twitter. They're like agitators, and he's always interacting with them, and I don't see him interacting with much else.
Did you write it all about the, were you going to add something or?
Well, I don't know, like, if he's reaction farming, if he's engagement farming, because these are a lot of the people, according to Taylor Lorenz, again, another kind of mainstream journalist who is famous for going after libs of TikTok. But she had an article out saying, well, you know, Elon Musk's, he, when he started paying people for their Twitter traffic, he started paying this community first. And right. It seems like he's fostering it.
Yeah, I think a lot of noise is being created now by certain people realizing, oh, I can, if I tweet this for like, you know, in the next week or the next 2 weeks, I can just click farm this. I mean, I think this is what has happened with the whole right-wing pundits talking about Sidney Sweeney endlessly. I feel like there's more important things to talk about. But, you know, I mean, if it's getting clicks on Twitter, I mean, they are getting paid by Musk for, you know, generating buzz.
Right. Yeah.
So that could very well be the case with this as well.
And I don't want to assume the worst, you know, like it's some kind of scheme behind the scenes for Elon Musk to be pushing kind of pro-interventionist propaganda. I think it probably is just trying to foster a community, which is what it appears to be.
So out of curiosity, do we know anything about how he got this name Barbecue?
Yeah, so the story that I've heard is that his mother was a street vendor who sold food, barbecued food. And that's when he was a child, he would help her sell it. Now, so I don't remember who said this. I don't know if it was Daniel McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute, but he said, you know, if this guy were running for office in Texas, everyone would love him with a name like Barbecue. But instead, now the implication is, oh, well, you're a cannibal, or you burn your opponents in this gang war.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's also what I heard, was that that he got it from like meat vending or whatever on the streets in Haiti. And it's like that's been glossed over, though, by people that are like pushing this narrative. What do you think the dangers are of this stuff getting pushed right now? This kind of, you know, I mean, it's maybe it could turn out to be true, but it seems like, you know, it seems like there's reason to not believe these claims.
I think the ultimate irony of it is that all of these kind of right-wing culture warrior influencers hate Joe Biden, right? They're all, maybe they're pro-Trump, like kind of alt-right, whatever, or populist right, or whatever they are. But the ultimate irony of it is that it has the effect of advocating for an intervention that Joe Biden has wanted for years, or at least the Biden administration. Who knows what Joe Biden wants? But Blinken, Antony Blinken, has moved for this and petitioned the UN for another intervention in Haiti. First, they tried to get, you know, there was talk of the US leading it. Well, we don't want to lead it ourselves, probably can't sell it. Also, then it was Canada who was going to lead it, but Canada declined. Then now they're working on Kenya. And Kenya's Supreme Court actually shot it down, but then they were finding a loophole, and that's why Ariel Henry was in Kenya to try and negotiate this loophole to get that deployment. And so now you have this narrative. I think the culture warriors are trying to use it to say, well, look, Joe Biden wants to import cannibal, you know, Haitian cannibals who are now going to be imported to the United States, and we're going to have cannibalism here if we're not careful. That's kind of the narrative, but it advocates for Joe Biden's intervention.
Is that a concern for you as a libertarian? Where what I'm saying is, you know, I think you have certain right wingers now that want to push this narrative because it, you know, it gets people scared when they start hearing about cannibals. What if they come to the U.S. and all of this stuff? And I think there is a connection between, you know, being very, very trigger happy on war and being pro-war or pro-intervention. And then I think that can often create environments in the U.S. where there's clampdowns on U.S. citizens domestically. Do you worry about the ways in which, you know, I guess the warmongers can end up affecting us domestically as well?
Yeah, I think it kind of goes to the heart of what the antiwar.com project is, in terms of that domestic policy is oftentimes shaped by foreign policy. And of course, right now, the libertarian movement in the place that it's in is a great kind of mystery to me at this time, because there was all this energy behind taking over the Libertarian Party, but that didn't really turn out. And now we're kind of rudderless and leaderless. And we've kind of fractured into all these different groups with different pursuits. But I think that there is an element of it that is still pretty right wing culturally and tries to say, we can't just have this libertarian policy. We have to attach being culturally conservative with it. And with there's a huge element that is very anti-communist, very in a National Review kind of sense, almost. There's also an element that's very, very anti, like the trans agenda and anti, wokeism. And there's also one that is very like, we need to do something about immigration. Like, this is an invasion. And there's a lot of people in the libertarian scene that really buy into that. And I have some of my own feelings about it, but one of my really big concerns is that militarizing the border or doing things like clamping down on what is perceived and being sold as an invasion is probably going to have a problem for us with civil rights, right? I mean,
yeah, I think you nailed it there. The thing that gets me is I think militarization abroad leads to militarization. Home. Yeah. I mean, I think we saw it with the war on terror, Patriot Act and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of like from a libertarian point of view, the state puts you between a rock and a hard place by design. And it's like you have to choose between two really, really bad options. and from, I don't want to completely discount the concerns that some of my intellectual colleagues, not in a literal sense, but people who are fellow travelers, I don't want to dismiss out of hand their concerns culturally like that. But I know that they also don't like, destroying civil rights in the name of a proclaimed war, a declared war.
Is there anything else I missed with regards to this barbecue story? I mean, did we talk about the video that LaCour?
I think we touched on it briefly, but I think the thing with the video was essentially that it clearly was not Jimmy Barbecue in the video. Like, anyone who's seen a picture of Jimmy Barbecue would immediately know that this person is not Jimmy Barbecue. And Dan Cohen tweeted at him several times saying, like, hey, this is clearly not him. And Don LaCour doubled down on it. Really? It was crazy.
I guess I have to, so I want to address this because I know there's people listening that'll say, oh, I don't like Dan Cohen because he writes for Mint Press and Mint Press is connected to this. And how do you respond to the people that are going to try to attack the sources you used here? But I mean, he's not the only source you used, to be honest. So I don't.
Oh, sure. Sure. Yeah. I get the same thing from libertarians too, who are like, well, we hate Max Blumenthal because he's a tanky or something like that, or we hate, I'm not going to believe you because you cited the gray zone, or, name your kind of fellow travel. Oh, you like Caitlin Johnstone, and Caitlin Johnstone, loves antiwar.com and promotes your work all the time.
Well, I have not agreed with all these people myself, and I'm not a libertarian.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, that's why I brought it up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know. It's like you take, well, I've learned over the years that you take the good where the good is, and you don't have to take the rest. So if there's something you identify that's good information or a good point, I mean, again, like I alluded to.
I mean, also cited the guy from NBC News, which.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if there's journalism being done, it's like, well.
Anything else you want to add in closing or anything you want to plug here?
Yeah. Well, again, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on your show, JG. I like a lot of the stuff that you do, like on film and books, too. But at any rate, if you like my work, I've really been focusing my efforts on putting one column out at the Institute on Thursdays. And then I have an email list too and a membership website at vitaldissent.club. So dissent like a court opinion. That's the URL, or vitaldissent.com, but otherwise the libertarianinstitute.org.
Well, thank you again, Patrick McFarlane, for coming on Parallax News, and hopefully we can do this again in the future. Maybe we'll do a longer episode, but I felt like for this one, it should have been a little bit shorter, just because there's not much to say beyond the basic facts and what people are getting wrong about the Haiti stuff. But thank you again.
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. If you appreciate the work I do, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, that makes this show possible. I only have one advertiser, the mighty Mike Swanson of Wall Street Window, but otherwise this show is entirely listener-supported. So if you can, kick me some cash at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said...
Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.